FOMO.
You know, I think like a lot of type A ambitious people, I, you know, wanted to get good grades in high school to get into an Ivy League school and then get good grades in college, get the job in banking and then do well in banking to get into business school. So I think my, you know, out of Wharton, I was really determined to not stay on the treadmill and that path of the predictable, you know, really open my horizons to something new.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out, and it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. Hey there, FOMO Sapiens. For the first time ever, we have a live episode of FOMO Sapiens recorded at the Wharton School of Business down in Philadelphia. I made my way down there for the Latin America Conference, invited by my friends at WALASA, the Wharton Latin American Student Association, to interview an esteemed graduate of the school, Caroline Marin, who started out at Uber, moved on to a company called Rappi, which is a huge company in the tech space in Latin America. They get things to your door, last mile deliveries, and many other things. And now she has started a healthcare company, and it's called Leona. She actually drops that piece of news right in the interview. So enjoy the interview. Enjoy being at Wharton. And as you say in Latin America, when you want to get started, vamos.
Welcome back to FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. I'm your host, Patrick J. McGinnis, and today we are live at the Wharton Latin American Conference with Caroline Marin, talking about how to take the leap from COO to founder. Now, as you know, this season, our theme is taking bigger swings. And when you jump from COO of a very big unicorn into becoming a founder of a startup, that's a big swing. Now, Caroline Marin is the founder and CEO of Alilu, a platform for parents and caregivers to access pediatric care on demand. Before founding Alilu, she spent 5 years as COO of Rappi, which is a large logistics provider in Latin America. And before that, she was an executive at Uber, where she launched Uber in Uruguay and Argentina and later opened Uber Eats in Latin America. She was the general manager of Uber Eats in Mexico. And before all of that, Caroline worked in finance, first in investment banking at Credit Suisse for several years, and then at Endeavor in Buenos Aires. She has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business. I would like to hear a little bit more from the crowd on that. Thank you. There you go. At the University of Pennsylvania, and a master's degree in international studies from the Lauder Institute at the same university. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right. So I start with the same question every time, and I will, of course, not let you escape me. The question is this. Tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
I think that when I took the constraints off of myself, both in terms of what the right career path looks like and also geographically, everything changed. And I think the first time I really did that was working investment banking at Credit Suisse in New York, knew that it was definitely not my passion in life. And I decided I'm going to quit. I'm going to move to Buenos Aires and I'm going to work with Endeavor. And a lot of people thought I was crazy. Including my boss at Credit Suisse, but I think that, you know, allowing myself to do that really changed the way I've built my life, my career, and as you'll learn throughout the episode, it kind of set a precedent for a lot of decisions I've made since then.
Yeah, the escape from banking, I made it as well. Now, I think it's kind of interesting. I will comment, like, we are at the Wharton Latin American Conference, and you have two Norte Americanos here on the stage, Sean Keys, Aki sitting here. But obviously, you live in Mexico. I think I'm Argentine. So I think it's fair that we're up here. And I want to start this question with a softball, this whole interview, because, like, let's just get warmed up a little bit. You graduated from Wharton, where you also did the Lauder program, as I mentioned. So how does it feel to be back?
It feels great to be back. I love Philly. I went to Penn undergrad. I met my husband here, who's in the audience. We met at the Lauder program. So it feels awesome to be back. I actually, in the bookstore today, ran into undergrad classmates who were here for their fraternity reunion. Whoa. So sometimes I forget how old I am, but it feels fun to be back.
So you know, a decade later, you just mentioned you're coming up on your reunion. You're now the founder of a Latin American healthcare company. And just, you know, sitting in this room where you were once a student, like, was that the plan? Did you think, you know, someday I'm going to be the founder of a company?
I think building a healthcare company in Latin America, definitely couldn't have predicted that. I think starting a company, I've always wanted to start a company. You know, I was one of those people. My mom recently sent a picture to me of my first experience with offline marketing when I was 9 years old. I posted flyers throughout my neighborhood advertising my babysitting services. I started a jewelry company in high school. So I've always been fairly entrepreneurial, but I think the healthcare in Latin America definitely was unpredictable.
Okay, so we're going to get into the whole story behind that, but I want to get back. Let's go through your journey, because I think what I think is would serve the audience here today, just thinking about, I remember being an MBA, and like, you see these people up on the stage, and they're doing these things that you'd like to do as well, but most likely, the people in this room who are students are going to leave, and they're going to get a job in a tech company, big tech, or in private equity or venture capital. And so that road, how does one get from the road of, you know, the first steps into what you're doing today? It's not immediate. Some people go straight into it, and that's great, but not a lot of people do. And so let's start with your graduating and you're looking for a job. Like, what was the first step that you made out of Wharton?
So I joined Uber out of Wharton. Uber at that point was not big tech. It was a startup. It was an irrational decision by any way you would look at it. You know, I'd worked in investment banking. I'd earned a really good salary in my 20s. And Uber offered me $65,000 to start out of Wharton as a marketing manager. Never done marketing in my life on this new product. It wasn't even, my offer letter said special projects. Didn't even say Uber Eats. But I think that my willingness to make that irrational decision is really what set the stage for where I am today. You know, I think like a lot of type A ambitious people, I wanted to get good grades in high school to get into an Ivy League school and then get good grades in college, get the job in banking, and then do well in banking to get into business school. So I think out of Wharton, I was really determined to not stay on the treadmill and that path of the predictable, you know, really open my horizons to something new. And making the leap to join Uber was one of the best decisions I've ever made, for sure, that I think allowed me to end up where I am today.
I'm curious, though. I mean, I remember I interviewed with some companies, but like the FOMO made me go to Wall Street and work in the private equity firm. Like, was there like a pressure that you felt? Or did you feel like, did everybody sort of support you in that? Or did you feel like a little bit like you were tempted to do the more, you know, sort of the more conventional thing?
So I was sharing last night at dinner with some of the organizers of the conference. I actually intentionally left campus the week of consulting and banking recruiting. Said, I'm not going to fall prey to this.
That is real.
I've done this before. So I really was determined not to go down that path. A lot of people told me it was completely irrational, obviously. And in retrospect, it looks like a great decision. But at the time, for a lot of people, it was sort of, why are you doing this? But I just felt this really strong conviction that I wanted to try something completely different. I wanted to break into tech. And if I went back on the traditional path, I wouldn't be able to really see what else is out there.
So you go to Uber, and your experience in the past, you had been a banker. So you obviously, you know, you had a certain skill set. You'd worked at Endeavor, which most people probably know is an entrepreneurial organization across the world that helps entrepreneurs to scale their businesses. So it wasn't that you'd never, you know, been in that space, but here you are, you show up day one, special projects at Uber. Like, how was that entry for you? Like, were you comfortable? Did you sort of know what to do? Like, how was that transition into the world of like high stakes entrepreneurship?
Yeah, it was really fun, to be honest. I think I had worked in banking, and then actually during my summer at Wharton, I had a growth equity fund in Mexico and for the Development Finance Corporation for the U.S. government. I'd done finance, and I just didn't have as much fun doing any of that. And then I show up at Uber day one. We're literally, they called it the Uber Eats closet. I started in Philadelphia. The Uber ride-sharing employees were skeptical of this new food delivery thing. They literally give me a high-tech thermometer, and they say to me, okay, just go door-to-door. You got to talk to restaurants in Philly. Order takeout. I don't know if anyone listening to this has tried Uber Eats way back in the day, but the Uber is literally circulated with food in the car.
Sounds hygienic.
Yeah, not the most hygienic, but my high-tech thermometer, that's where it comes into play. Mm. So I ordered takeout from these restaurants. I would take the temperature of the food, taste it, put it in an insulated bag for 5 hours, take it out, take the temperature again, taste it again. And if it hadn't moved more than like 1 degree and still tasted okay, we could sell it on Eats. So that was my job out of Wharton. I was like going door to door, hustling, trying to talk to restaurant owners in Philly. Obviously, all the famous restaurant owners were like, this sounds disgusting. You know, like, I don't want to sell my food on this product. But my job was to convince them. And I think that, you know, having to convince anyone of anything is a great skill to hone in if you want to eventually be an entrepreneur. So that was how it started out. And obviously, the learning curve was really steep. But I think in a lot of ways, I felt like, oh, I was made for this. Like, I just really enjoyed the hustle, the scrappiness, the creativity that went into it. So I found it to be really fun.
FOMO.
Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now, that right there was Portuguese. And as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. 1 in 5 Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak 4 languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Your business gets to a certain size and the cracks start to emerge. Things you used to do in a day are taking a week. You don't have one source of truth. If this is you, you should know these 3 numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000. That's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. Happy birthday. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close the books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1. Because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs. Those are key performance indicators in one efficient system. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know the show is all about making better decisions. And with this product, you can make better decisions because you have all the information you need right in one place. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/FOMO. That's netsuite.com/FOMO to get your own KPI checklist. Because you know what? KPIs are better than ice cream. netsuite.com/FOMO.
FOMO.
And then talk about how you ended up going to Latin America.
So the fun story is that the reason I actually ended up at Uber is that when I was at Wharton, you know, one day someone from Uber came to speak on campus and talked about this role called being an international launcher. That sounded like my dream job. It was Uber would send you alone to a country, and you basically had to start Uber from scratch. You know, you had to negotiate with the regulators, find the first drivers, find influencers, come up with a marketing strategy. And I was like, that is my dream job. I get to travel around the world, launching a business. But that team wasn't hiring. So I ended up in Uber Eats, actually, because they said, you know, we're not hiring for launchers in the ride-sharing business, but we're going to launch a new product. So, you know, after a few months of building Uber Eats, we actually never launched the first version in Philly. So I ended up going to New York a lot, where we had a live product. We decided that there was product market fit for food delivery in Uber, but we needed to build a separate app to be able to scale selection. So Uber Eats was going to be on hold for like 6 weeks. So I reached out to the international expansion team at Uber. They already knew me because I had interviewed with them. And I said, can I go launch country now? I'm already here. You know, I have a little bit. And they said, if you can be in Uruguay in 5 days, go launch Uber ride sharing. So I actually kept
my... So dramatic, by the way.
Yeah, so
just
dramatic.
Just like think about that. I mean, it's just... Could it have been a week? You know what I mean?
It was a very, you know, we were going to launch soon. So I kept my apartment in Philly, kept all my stuff, thought I was coming back 6 weeks later. Here I am in Latin America still like 9 years later. So I got on a plane to Uruguay and I launched Uber ride sharing. And that's how I ended up in Latin America at Uber. I was actually hired in the U.S., launched Uber ride sharing in Uruguay. I have some crazy stories pertaining to that. And then I went to Argentina, launched Uber ride sharing in Buenos Aires.
So I am curious. I mean, I'd love to hear Uber, which I love. I mean, I think many of us do, just because it made riding so safe all over the world, no matter where you are. But it definitely was controversial. And when you have, like, you know, sindicatos and stuff like that. It is not a popular thing. It's really hard to bring these transformative technologies into industries that are deeply entrenched within an economy. And so I imagine you weren't like the most popular person in certain sectors of Uruguayan society. Talk a little bit about those early days in Uruguay and some of the things that you learned.
Yeah, no, it was a wild experience. So another fun fact about me is that the other job offer I almost took when I graduated from Wharton instead of Uber was for the Secret Service for a program called the Special Advisors Program. And my family was convinced, based on my insane experience at Uber in Uruguay and Argentina, that I had actually taken the Secret Service job. I couldn't tell anyone where I lived. We had bodyguards. We had to escape from buildings. We were certainly not popular. You know, there was a reason that Uber wasn't hiring any more international launchers. It was because there was not that many countries left to launch, except for the really hard ones. Mm. And so it was a really challenging experience. But I think something I learned at Uber and that I loved about working at Uber is that we really felt very strongly that we were building a product and service that was driving a lot of value for the world. You know, it was making it safer for riders to get from point A to point B, and it was creating earning opportunities for any Uruguayo, Argentino. So even though we had a lot of resistance, I felt this very strong belief that what we were doing was a fundamentally good thing. And so I think that it just took a lot of resilience to make it work. And it was definitely a crazy adventure. I mean, the first day that we onboarded drivers in Buenos Aires, there was a bomb threat in the building where we were trying to onboard. You know, it was definitely a little bit scary. And, you know, part of my job was to keep my team safe and keep the drivers safe, which was a lot of responsibility. But I also loved the adrenaline rush and the adventure of trying to make it work. And ultimately, those are both very large markets for Uber today.
Can you contrast, I think it's kind of interesting, you know, working for a U.S. company in America versus working at that sucursal, like the local level, does it still feel like you're working for a U.S. company? Does it feel like you're of that region? Like, what is that sort of kind of cultural vibe that's happening?
Yeah, I'm sure this is something that varies greatly from company to company. One thing that I think Uber did incredibly well that allowed Uber to be such a successful global company was that Uber really empowered its local general managers and its local launchers. And so I am American, but my team was all Uruguayos for the most part, except for the other launcher who's from Costa Rica. But I think Uber did a really good job of really empowering the local teams. And I think that's one of the reasons why Uber was able to expand so quickly. So there were things that, you know, as a launcher, I felt like we had our own little company, our own little business, our own little team that was really trying to make this business work and get it off the ground. I think, you know, later down the line when I moved to Mexico 7.5 years ago to open Uber Eats there and I was the general manager of Uber Eats, there I started to feel some of the tension of, you know, for example, when we launched Uber Eats in Mexico, Uber didn't accept cash payments. Now, if you know anything about the Mexican economy, if you want to grow a meaningful business in Mexico, you need to accept cash payments because cash is still the primary form of payment in Mexico. And so there were experiences like that that were maybe frustrating where I had to get on a plane to San Francisco and explain to them how big of an unlock this would be for the business if we could accept cash payments in Uber Eats in Mexico. So there were definitely moments like that where you could feel, okay, this is a U.S. company that, you know, I need them to understand the local ways of doing business. But I do think in general, Uber did a pretty good job of empowering the local teams to hire locally and to feel local and win locally.
And in terms of, like, obviously you're American, you're completely bicultural, you speak great Spanish and everything, but it is different. Was being an American working in Latin America an advantage, a disadvantage? Was there a trade-off? Like, how did that sort of play out in how you navigated these organizations?
I think it really depends on the situation. So there are definitely situations in which I think, particularly being a female leader, I think the fact that I am from the U.S. has helped a little bit because you have this other layer of complexity that, you know, people say, okay, maybe she's learned in other places where you've studied. But I think, for example, with Uber, I wanted the role of being the general manager in Mexico. Obviously, the head of Uber Eats globally was like, do you even speak Spanish? Like, why would I hire someone like you to open, like, the most important market for us in Latin America? And I think in that sense, and I think this applies to all areas of life in general, I really had to prove myself. So before I interviewed for the general manager role in Mexico, I got on a plane from Uruguay and I spent 4 days going really, really deep into research and food delivery in Mexico to make sure that when I presented my case at Uber, and I was already an Uber employee at this point, I had just as much, if not more, knowledge than any Mexican they could possibly interview for the role. So I think you do have to be aware of who you are and where you come from and close that gap. And so I've always kind of gone above and beyond, I guess, in the sense of doing my research and making sure that they can't say that necessarily a Mexican would be better suited for the job, but I think that's on you as a foreigner to make sure that's not an issue.
So you move up to Mexico. You start to chilangize your accent away from Uruguayo.
Yeah.
and then this Rappi opportunity comes up. Talk about the move to Rappi. Like, what kind of... It's a big inflection point. You're going from, you know, a company that you had been with for a number of years in multiple markets that had developed very prestigious. I mean, it's everywhere, right? I mean, we use it all the time. To a big emerging player in Latin America in a big role. So how did the opportunity come your way? And then how did you sort of, what was your decision-making process?
Yeah, so the opportunity came my way. It's sort of funny. We were doing well at Uber Eats in Mexico. We were at that point in time, we were beating Rappi. And so I guess I was on their radar screen. And, you know, Simon, the CEO and one of the co-founders of Rappi, reached out to me asking if I wanted to have dinner. And I actually told my boss at Uber, you know, I said, like, hey, the CEO, because they were the competitor, wants to have dinner, should I go? And he's like, yeah, you should totally go. And when I met Simone, the first thing I said to him is, like, you know, I would never work for the competition. But the founders of Rappi are incredible entrepreneurs. I mean, I don't know if you ever have a chance to meet them. They're smart, they're charismatic, they have incredible drive. And I think, you know, on this journey to eventually where I am today, becoming an entrepreneur, being surrounded by or working with incredible entrepreneurs is the best way to learn how to become a great entrepreneur. And so, you know, it was not a quick decision. It was a long process of getting to know each other, but they just have this contagious energy and this desire to change the world, honestly, and this optimism that I really wanted to be around. So I think that was a huge part of it. I also think that, you know, at Uber, I had an incredible career at Uber, and I was able to learn a lot and grow a lot, but I was a general manager, not in the U.S. I wasn't working directly with the founder, and so I think that making that leap was really exciting to me. I also think I found this unique, and I think this is something anyone has to think about when they're seeking out new opportunities. You know, what had allowed us to be successful at Uber Eats in Mexico was we had great operational excellence. We had the fastest delivery times, the best selection. I really spent very little on marketing to grow. And I felt this unique match between, you know, Rappi was really incredible at a lot of different things, but where I think maybe the biggest areas of opportunity were this operational excellence. So I felt like this great match between, okay, I'm going to be able to go and add value, but I can also learn from these incredible founders. And I think the last thing I would say is I love this idea of built in Latin America for Latin America. You know, there's a lot of things that you do differently when you come from the region and you understand the region. You know, Rappi from day one was a super app, which means you could literally order anything on demand. Rappi was born that way because Rappi really had this unique insight around what the region needed and wanted that I did feel like at times was maybe lacking at Uber.
FOMO. FOMO.
So you're deciding to go to Rappi, right? And you're at this point, I got to think, you know what you're doing. You've worked in the industry. You've come up. You're at a point in your career where, like, you know what you want. You know what you don't want to do. You know, you've got leverage. I mean, they're trying to get you to join them. And that's, like, leverage is everything. I've just come to believe that. I mean, it is, when you have leverage, magic can happen. So I'm just curious, like, as you're talking to them and you're kind of scoping out the role and putting it together with them and having the conversations, like, what did you care about? Like, what were you optimizing for?
I think I was optimizing for the ability to really build. You know, I am happiest when I have a lot of autonomy and I feel like I love pressure. So I love having a lot of accountability and pressure, but the autonomy to do what I need to do to make it happen. So I think that the, you know, the role and what I was going to be focused on was important to me. I think working directly with the founders was also important to me because I felt like that was one of the big things I was going to be able to learn in this new position. So I think those were probably the most important things. You know, I am a strong believer that you should negotiate basically everything in life. So, you know, there were also negotiations as in any new opportunity. And like you said, when you have leverage, magical things can happen. So I will take advantage of this to throw out there that you should always negotiate. So, you know, there was some negotiating that happened. But in general, I think what I really cared about was being able to work closely with the founders and really get to leave my mark on the company and feel like my position was going to be meaningful.
And when did you join exactly?
I joined in August of 2018, post-Series C. We were just about to close the round that valued the company at $1 billion.
All right, good timing. And so then you join an eventful number of years. Like, obviously we had a pandemic, if you guys remember. I remember that too. It was extreme in Latin America. The lockdowns in Latin America were, I mean, many of you were there, so I don't need to tell you, which created a lot of opportunities, created a lot of operational challenges as well. We had the digitalization of Latin America going forward like 10 years. So like incredible tailwinds, operational headwinds, all this kind of stuff. You know, we could just do a whole 45 minutes on Rappi, but you know, we have other things to hit. But could you distill, like, in that time at Rappi, like, what was the, when you look back, like, you're writing your biography in 23 years, what will be the big takeaway for that time?
It's hard to say just one takeaway. I mean, you talk about the pandemic. I think we felt an incredible sense of responsibility in the sense of, like you said, you know, you had all of these people who historically would never have tried e-commerce or on-demand delivery that had no option but to, you know, they couldn't go to the grocery store, so they wanted to order groceries online. So you had this huge boom in that sense, but at the same time, we felt this response, and we felt responsible in the sense of, we're really lucky that we have a platform where we can solve this huge societal need. But at the same time, we needed to keep our couriers safe, and we need to keep our restaurant partners and grocery store partners safe. You know, at that point in time, people were literally scared to go in the street.
Yeah, so, they were washing their groceries.
You know, we spent an insane amount of time negotiating with providers in China trying to get, you know, face masks when you couldn't get, say, face masks easily or hand sanitizer. Or, you know, we launched COVID insurance for our couriers. We're basically like, if you got COVID while you were doing deliveries, we would continue to pay you for a period of time. And so I think we felt this incredible sense of responsibility. It was hard, but it was also very exciting. You know, you see demand grow 3x from one day to the next, but where are you going to get these, like, how are you going to deliver the orders? And there was this huge opportunity because a lot of people lost their jobs, and being a courier, working at one of our partners was a way for them to earn an income, but how do you do it in a safe way? So I think it was an exciting time, but it was also, you know, it felt like a lot of responsibility. But I think in general, it just, you know, one thing that is so incredible about Rappi and that I admire so much about the founders, I think Rappi was one of the first companies to attract meaningful venture capital dollars to the region. And I think that the founders and the whole executive team, the whole company, takes that responsibility very seriously around, you know, we need to make sure this works so that other people continue to have the opportunity to, you know, to be invested in the region. And I think one of the really cool things about working at Rappi, and one thing I've learned from the founders, is if you look at the number of ex-Rappi entrepreneurs in Latin America, it's pretty incredible. It rivals like the PayPal mafia. They call it the Rappi mafia. And I think that really is because the culture we built at Rappi, where we really have this entrepreneurial DNA, but also the fact that the founders are so supportive about people going and building in the region. And, you know, if you look at Simon and Sas and Felipe, the founders of Rappi, they've invested in so many different startups throughout the region. So I think that's also one of the takeaways, which is like, how do you pay it forward? It's not just about building your company and making it successful, but how do you create this multiplier effect where everyone who, like, people go to your company, work at your company, help make it a success, but then go on to do other really exciting things that continue to drive an impact in the region.
Yeah, and in Latin America, that is the game. I mean, it's in any startup ecosystem, if you look at Mercado Libre and the impact of that, If you have a culture where you are encouraging people to start companies, to fund companies, I mean, this is what creates not just having three unicorns and a bunch of, you know, subscale companies, but having an actual tech ecosystem that grows at hyper speed. So that's a really important point. Now, obviously, amazing, crazy set of years, and yet you decide to make a move and to start your own thing. Talk about, I mean, you know, kind of where that came from. Like, you know, the voice inside your head started speaking to you that you maybe wanted to make a change. Where did it come from, and what were you hearing?
Yeah, I think it was a culmination of a lot of different factors. One thing I'll say that may be surprising is that, so I have two young kids. I have a 2.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. And interestingly, when I had my daughter, who's Lucia, who's the 2.5-year-old, I almost became more ambitious. And what I mean by that is I just was much more thoughtful about how I spend my time. Because you're, you know, you have this baby that you love more than anything in the world. And if you're going to be away from that baby 12 to 15 hours a day working on something, you need to feel like it's really worth it. And so I think that was one catalyst. You know, like I said, ever since I was a little kid, I've been pretty entrepreneurial, but I started to feel more urgency around, I need to go do this. Like I started being much more thoughtful about it in that sense. I think also, you know, you accumulate this experience, and I think this is really important. People, whenever they ask me advice around, like, should I take this job or the other job, I've always thought about all of the jobs I've had around, like, what are you learning in that experience? What are the skills that you want to get out of it? And I also was reaching a point where, okay, there's never an ideal moment to start a company, but I feel like I've accumulated a lot of skills that would help me and allow me to be a more successful entrepreneur now than maybe I would have been 10 years ago. And sometimes you just have to, like, rip the Band-Aid off and do it. You just have, there's no perfect moment. You just need to go try. But I think that my daughter being born was that catalyst of, okay, like, I felt more urgency with my time, and that's when the wheels really started turning around, okay, what's going to be next? What am I going to build?
All right. You know, it's funny. I'm just thinking, we were talking before about a woman called Kate Ryder, who's the founder of Maven Clinic, which is a massive health tech company, who you saw the other day, who's a friend of mine, and she's been on FOMO Sapiens, and I was doing research on her, and she said the question that nobody should ever ask her is, how do you do it all? Because she's got, like, a number of children, because nobody asked that of her husband. And it just made me, it's interesting because, like, I was clearly not going to ask you that, but also, like, you kind of gave the answer, which is, like, many executives have lots of priorities, but when your new priority becomes crystal clear, it's sort of like it can be the launch pad for the next moves in your career. Talk about the new company and where the idea came from.
Yeah, so I so we're building a digital healthcare company, and our mission is really to radically simplify access to high quality healthcare throughout Latin America. And we're building on WhatsApp, which I'll explain in a minute. The idea was born from personal experience. So I didn't set out to build in healthcare. I am a very impact driven person, in that what I care the I you know, I'm the kind of person kind of break through brick walls if I care a lot about what I'm doing, but I'm also not that motivated if I don't feel really passionately about the issue I'm trying to solve. So I was trying to work on ideas for a long time, and I was looking at a lot of ideas that were more directly related to my experience at Uber and Rappi and marketplaces, logistics. And in this period of time, my kids got sick. They're totally fine now, but they got bronchitis, and my son, Ollie, was only like 4 months old, and I had to go to the pediatrician like 5 or 6 times in 3 weeks, and it was just an extremely frustrating and expensive experience. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, there's got to be a better way. So I started researching. You know, I was already in research mode for ideas, but in general, I'm the kind of person who likes to read a lot about something when I want to learn more about it. And so the way that it works in Mexico is approximately 70% of healthcare spend in Mexico is out of pocket. That is dramatically different from the U.S. and a lot of other countries. In the U.S., you have about 93% insurance penetration if you take into consideration Medicare and Medicaid. In Mexico, you have less than 7% insurance penetration, and it's called catastrophic insurance. So it really only covers major medical events. You know, I've had great insurance through Uber and Rappi over the last 7.5 years, and I've only ever been able to use it twice for giving birth. Nothing else has ever been covered. So when I go to the pediatrician, it's $100 out of pocket for a 5-minute conversation with a doctor. Because, you know, you're in the waiting room, then a nurse comes in, and then you have to buy all the medications out of pocket. The whole thing with my kids having bronchitis probably cost me $1,000.
Wow.
Which in Mexico is just wild to think about, right? The average Mexican clearly cannot afford that. But at the same time, you have some other things that are really unique about healthcare in Mexico, where if you have access to the best private sector doctors, they will talk to you on WhatsApp. They'll diagnose on WhatsApp. They'll prescribe medicine on WhatsApp. And I was just thinking, like, why couldn't we do this whole thing on WhatsApp? You know, like, why did I have to come here 6 times? And WhatsApp is really the operating system in Latin America. In Mexico, you have 90 million smartphone users and 89 million WhatsApp users. So I started digging, and at first I thought about building some sort of doctor tooling, but I really want to solve this problem for millions of people. And I think one thing that I did learn at Uber and Rappi is, like, how do you really shift paradigms and think about a completely new way of doing things? You know, 15 years ago, the idea of getting in a stranger's car was wild. And now it's the most common thing. We take Ubers every day. But 15 years ago, we thought it was safer to take a taxi. And Uber over time was able to prove with technology that that actually wasn't true. And we're really thinking about healthcare in a similar way, which is today people think, oh, but my doctor knows me. They know my kids' names. That's the safer option. But in reality, when you're talking to your doctor on WhatsApp, they're totally confused. They don't have an electronic health record in front of you. Our pediatrician confuses our kids' names all the time. He's great. He responds in a couple of minutes or less, but he doesn't have the tools. You know, we're scrolling up in an infinite chat to see what he prescribed last time. So I have this strong belief that with tech and with AI today, we can really build a much more personalized, much safer experience where you write, we have your whole medical history, we know exactly who we're talking to, and we can make it much easier and much more convenient and safer, to be honest, to get access to really high quality care. So that's the mission we're on, and we're starting with pediatrics because that was where my pain point was born from, but also because parents will do anything for their kids. So adults really have to often wait till they feel like they're very sick to go to the doctor. And if you look at Latin America, because the financial burden of care is largely on the patient, there really is no culture of preventative care, and you have one of the sickest populations in the world. If you look at rates of obesity, diabetes, gastrointestinal disease, respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, but no matter the income level, people want the best for their kids. And so we think it's a smart place to start. And there's also just way higher frequency. You go to the pediatrician like 6 to 9 times a year on average in the first few years of life.
FOMO. FOMO.
Now, you mentioned building on WhatsApp, which I'm curious. I mean, it makes sense, right? Everybody uses WhatsApp. It's great technology. It's ubiquitous, and people use it anyway. But there is some risk that you're building on somebody else's, you know, land, as it were. So how do you think about the risk versus, like, sort of the reward of doing that?
Yeah, I think long term, for sure, we imagine ourselves having our own app and our own ecosystem. But I also think it's really hard to change. In general, it's hard to change consumer behavior. But in healthcare, it's extremely hard to change consumer behavior. So if I tell you I have this great solution, but first you have to download this app and fill out this form and go through this really extensive process, you're going to kill the conversion funnel. And I really want the experience to be, you know, you go to Google and you're Googling what to do when your child has 102 fever, and within 2 clicks, you're talking to a doctor instead of self-diagnosing or, you know, modeling the natural behavior in a group chat on WhatsApp with other moms or dads. And you're saying, hey, this thing is going on with my kid. What do I do? Share the contact and you're talking to someone. So we really view it more as a way of get people to try our product, make it really, really, truly simple.
Reduce friction as much as possible.
Reduce friction as much as possible. And then once we have critical mass, and people see the value that we're driving, there are a lot of things that we want to do outside of WhatsApp. So we do imagine eventually having our own ecosystem.
Okay, so that seems very sensible. I get you. Now, I heard a rumor. Well, it's not a rumor because you told me, but you told me that you raised your first round without a deck, which that is notable. I mean, that is... like, when does that happen, right? Right? Yes. Woo! Now, you've all just spent the last 40 minutes listening to Caroline. She's very impressive and deeply experienced. But even so, without a deck, talk about that. How did you raise the money?
So I was really fortunate to raise from some incredible investors. I raised from General Catalyst and Accel, as well as some incredible angels. And
they didn't want a deck?
So I did make a deck after I raised to just like illustrate what we were, it's an embarrassing deck. I definitely don't want to share it. It was more like illustrate what we were talking about. But I think this is a really important point, which is that my, you know, how did I do that? I spent the last 15 years of my life building a career and a reputation and business results that speak for themselves and relationships, to be honest. And I think that, you know, people think of this, like, we love to put, like, pretend there's all this glamour around starting a company and, like, you're, like, a rock star that goes out and does your road show and you have this cool deck and you raise money. Like, the reality is investors are looking for people they can trust to build and execute on a vision, right? So obviously you have to have the vision, you have to have the idea, you have to have done your research, which I did a lot of research. I've probably done over 30 hours of UX interviews before I went to raise the money. But I think that, you know, what I already knew these people from previous, you know, I didn't know all of my investors actually, but they knew people who knew me enough to be able to say, okay, is this someone we can believe in? Is this someone who we believe is going to be able to execute on? And I think that's really the most important thing, much more so than like, what are the tips to raise the best round? Of course, there's like tactics and things like that, but I think it's really more about your track record.
Substance.
Yeah.
Right? Substance over flash.
Exactly.
All right. We're going to take questions in 1 second, but I'll ask you one more question before we do that. Question is this. Give me the big vision.
So the big vision is a world in which millions of people, literally millions, similar like what I was saying with Uber, think of us as the first stop when you're not feeling well, you have a question, your kid's not feeling well, your partner's not feeling well, you have anything related to healthcare, you come to us first. You write to us, and if it's something that we can treat, we will treat it for you. And it's really quick and it's really simple. And, you know, we prescribe, we can send the whatever the prescription is directly to your house. But if it is something more serious, you trust us to refer you into the right person to be seen, or we go to your home. And so I really envision a world in which it's affordable and super convenient, you know, to take care of yourself and your loved ones. It's actually really crazy to me. If you look at everything that's happened in the consumer world around, like, we now expect, you order from Amazon and you expect your goods to be delivered the same day. You know, at Rappi, we launched Tortable. We can get you your grocery order in 10 minutes or less. But engaging with a healthcare system is a really intimidating, stressful experience still. And I think everything we've done in the rest of the consumer space, or we're starting to do in fintech, why can't we do it in healthcare? Why can't we make it convenient, not stressful, to be healthier? And so I think that that's the world that we imagine, where it's super simple and it's just not a stressful experience anymore to engage with the healthcare system.
And Mexico only, or regional?
No, we view this as being global. Yeah. So first focus on Latin America. We definitely want to expand outside of Mexico throughout the rest of Latin America. We think that eventually this could work in a lot of different places, though. Anywhere where it is expensive, stressful, and healthcare outcomes aren't great.
America.
We think that there's an opportunity so our new name will be Leona, for Leona to exist.
All right, so Caroline, we're going to move on now to the lightning round. Lightning round.
Okay.
Very important part of every episode. Usually 4 questions. I'm adding a 5th question just for this particular event.
Okay.
And the first question, which is special for today, is favorite Latin pop star or rock star?
Ooh, this is... I'm going to say a controversial one just because I don't know if it's my all-time favorite, but I am a fan at the moment, and I got to rep Mexico, Peso Pluma.
Peso Pluma. I am sorry. The correct answer was either Charlie Garcia, Shakira, or Conociendo Rusia. But...
Anita's a good one, too.
Or Talia. Oh, there's a lot. Okay.
There's a lot.
Okay, now, number 2. What is a favorite quote?
A favorite quote. If you think adventure is dangerous... try routine, it's lethal.
Oh, from whom?
By Paulo Coelho.
Wow, that is amazing. Thank you for that.
I'm not a routine person, in case you can tell.
Nor am I. That's why we get along. All right, number 3. Name one book or podcast that every FOMO Sapiens should know about.
Okay, I'm going to say $2. I know I'm cheating. But if you're building a company, while this may sound boring and a lot of people recommend it, I highly recommend Good to Great by Jim Collins, but specifically the chapter on the concept of the flywheel. I think that's something I learned at Uber, and it's just been very informative throughout my career. So I highly recommend that. And then there's another book that's less well-known that I highly recommend called You're Not Listening by an author named Kate Murphy. And it basically talks about how we've evolved into a society where we talk and we project and we don't listen enough. And I think there's a lot of really interesting insights.
All right. I like that. No, I've not heard of that one. Number four, what is one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self?
I think that there's no right path. You know, I sort of alluded to this earlier in the interview, but for a very long time, I was on the treadmill, right? Like, go to the school, get these grades, then get that job, then do this next thing. And I think that once I broke free from that, honestly, my career has been a lot more fun, but I also think I've just been able to grow exponentially and really broaden my horizons.
Yeah, FOMO sapiens don't do treadmills. Except for, like, to get in shape for a marathon or something. Final, what's your most important memory?
A lot of important memories, but one of my earliest important memories was actually when I learned how to ride a bike. So I was like very chubby baby, like extremely chubby, and I was too young to learn how to ride a bike, but I'm a very determined person, and it's crazy I even remember this, but I remember, you know, my family saying I was too young to learn how to ride the bike, but I was so determined to learn how to ride a bike, and I just like practiced, and then my parents always say this, like, once I learned how to ride the bike, I just like, I was unstoppable, lost all the baby weight, and just like was constantly on the go. And I think why is that such an important memory to me, or why does it stand out so much? One, I love being told that I can't do something. It's like, if you want to fire me up and get me motivated, tell me you don't think I can do it. And I think the other thing is just like the determination and persistence always pays off. Ever since I was like a little kid trying to learn how to ride the bike. But I think you can do literally anything if you're determined and persistent enough.
All right. Caroline Marin, founder and CEO of Leona. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOSapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOSapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOSapiens.com.